Chapter 37. King Saul Boulevard, Tel Aviv. MI5 had the imposing graystone solemnity of Thames House. The CIA had the glass and steel sprawl of Langley. The office had King Saul Boulevard. It was drab, featureless, and best of all, anonymous. No emblem hung over its entrance, no brass lettering proclaimed its occupant. In fact, there was nothing at all to suggest it was the headquarters of one of the world's most feared and respected intelligence services. A closer inspection of the structure would have revealed the existence of a building within a building, one with its own power supply, its own water and sewer lines, and its own highly secure communication system. Employees carried two keys. One opened an unmarked door in the lobby, the other operated the elevator. Those who committed the unpardonable sin of losing one or both of their keys were banished to the Judean wilderness, never to be seen or heard from again. Gabriel had come through the lobby just once, the day after his first encounter with Jemron. From that point forward, he had only entered the building black, through the underground garage. He did so again now, with Jemron at his side. Emil Sheret, the director, was waiting in the foyer with Uzi Mavolt at his side. Gabriel's relations with Amos were cool at best, but none of that mattered now. Gabriel's wife, an office agent, was missing and presumed to be in the hands of a proven murderer who had sworn vengeance. After expressing his condolences, Amos made it clear the complete arsenal of the office, both human and technical, was now at Gabriel's disposal. Then he led Gabriel into a waiting elevator, followed by Jemron and Mavolt.
"I've cleared an office for you on the top floor," Amos said. "You can work from there."
"Where's my team?"
"The usual place."
"Then why should I work on the top floor?"
Amos stabbed at a button on the control panel. The elevator headed down. For many years, it had been a dumping ground for obsolete computers and worn-out furniture, often used by officers of the night staff as a place for romantic trysts. Now, room 456C, a cramped subterranean chamber 3 levels beneath the lobby, was known as Gabriel's lair. Affixed to the door was a faded paper sign, Temporary Committee for the Study of Terror Threats in Western Europe. Gabriel tore it away, then punched the code into the electronic combination lock. The room they entered was littered with the debris of operations past, and, some claimed, haunted by their ghosts. Seated at the communal work tables were the members of Gabriel's team, Dina and Ramona, Yakov and Yossi, Eli Levan and Mikhail. They had been joined by 5 additional officers, a pair of all-purpose field operatives, Odev and Mordecai, and 3 young geniuses from Technical, who specialized in covert cyber ops. They were the same 3 men who had raided Ivan's bank accounts in the days after his wife's defection. For the past several days, their frightening collection of skills had been focused on the financial holdings of another Russian oligarch, Viktor Orlov. Gabriel stood at the head of the room and surveyed the faces before him. He saw only anger and determination. These same men and women had carried out some of the most daring and dangerous operations in office history. At that moment, not one questioned their ability to locate Kiara and bring her home. If for some reason they failed, then tears would be shed. But not now, and not in front of Gabriel. He stood before them in silence, his gaze moving slowly from wall to wall, over the faces of the dead. Khaled al-Khalifa, Ahmed bin Shafiq, Zizi al-Bakari, Youssef Ramadan. There were many more, of course, almost too many to recall. They were murderers all, and each deserved the death sentence that Gabriel had administered. He should have killed Ivan as well. Now Ivan had taken Gabriel's wife. Regardless of the outcome, Ivan would spend the rest of his life a hunted man. So too would anyone remotely connected to the affair. They stood no chance of survival. Gabriel would find them all, no matter how long it took, and he would kill each and every one of them. For now, though, punishing the guilty would have to wait. Finding Kiara was all that mattered. They would start the search by locating the man who had planned and executed her abduction, the man who had introduced himself to Irina Bogdanova as Anatoly, friend of Viktor Orlov, the man who had just made the biggest mistake of his professional career. Gabriel hung his photograph now in the gallery of the dead, and then he told his team a story. There is a memorial not far from King Saul Boulevard. It is dedicated to those who have served and fallen in secret.
It is fashioned from smooth sandstone and shaped like a brain, because Israel's founders believed only the brain would keep their small country safe from those who wished to destroy it. The walls of the memorial are engraved with the names of the dead and the dates on which they perished. Other details about their lives and careers are kept locked away in the file room. More than 500 intelligence officers from Israel's various services are honored there. 75 are office. Two names would be added in the coming days. Two good boys who died because Gabriel had tried to keep a promise. Chiarazzoli, he said, would not be the third name. The Italian police were now engaged in a frantic effort to find her. Gabriel, his voice calm and unemotional, said the Italian effort would not prove successful. In all likelihood, Chiara had been removed from Italian soil even before the search had begun. At this moment, she could be anywhere. She might be heading eastward across the former lands of the Soviet Empire that the Russians referred to as their near abroad. Or perhaps she was already somewhere in Russia. Or perhaps she's not in Russia at all, Gabriel added. Yvonne controls one of the world's largest shipping and air freight companies. Yvonne has the capability to conceal Chiara anywhere on Earth. Yvonne has the capability to put her in motion and keep her in motion in perpetuity. That meant Yvonne had an unfair advantage. But they had leverage, too. Yvonne had not taken Chiara simply to kill her. Surely Yvonne wanted something else. It gave them time and room to maneuver. Not much time, Gabriel said, and very little room. They would start by trying to find the man Yvonne had used as his tool of vengeance. For now, he was but a few lines of charcoal on an otherwise blank canvas. They were going to complete the picture. He did not materialize out of thin air, this man. He had a name and a past. He had a family. He lived somewhere. He existed. Everything about him suggested he was former KGB, a man who specialized in finding people who wished not to be found, a man who could make people disappear without a trace, a man who now worked for wealthy Russians like Ivan Kharkov. A man like that did not exist in a vacuum. People had to know about him in order to obtain his services. They were going to find such a person, and they would start their search in the city where the affair began, the Russian city, sometimes referred to as London. Chapter 38. Though Gabriel had no way of knowing it, he was correct about at least one thing. Chiara had not remained on Italian soil for long. In fact, within hours of her abduction, she had been moved eastward across the country to a fishing village in the region known as La Marche. There she was placed aboard a trawler and taken out to sea for what appeared to be a night of work in the Adriatic. At 2:15 a.m., as officers of the Polizia di Stato were standing watch at Italy's border crossings, she was transferred to a private motor yacht called the Anastasia. By dawn, the yacht had returned to a sleepy port along the coast of Montenegro. The newly independent former Yugoslav Republic, it was now home to thousands of Russian expatriates and an important base of operations for the Russian mafia. She would not stay in that country for long either. By mid-morning, as Gabriel's flight was touching down at Ben-Gurion, she was being loaded onto a cargo plane at an airfield outside the Montenegrin capital. According to documents on board, the aircraft was owned by a Bahamian-based shipping company called Lukotrans. What the documents did not say was that Lukotrans was actually a corporate shell controlled by none other than Ivan Kharkov. Not that it would have mattered to the Montenegrin customs officials. The bribe they received for not inspecting the plane or its contents was more than triple their monthly government salaries. Chiara knew none of this. Indeed, her last clear memory was of the nightmare at the gate of Villa dei Fiori. It had been dark when they arrived. Exhausted by the operation in Como, Chiara had dozed intermittently during the long drive and woke as Leora was easing up to the security gate. To open it required the correct 6-digit code. Leora was entering it into the keypad when the men with black hoods emerged from the trees. Their weapons dispensed death with little more than a whisper. Morty had been hit first, Leora second. Chiara had been reaching for her Beretta when she was given a single disabling blow to the side of her head. Then she had felt a stab in her right thigh, an injection of sedative that made her head spin and turned her limbs to dead weight. The last thing she remembered was the face of a woman looking down at her.
"Behave, and we might let you live,"
the woman said in Russian-accented English. Then the woman's face turned to water, and Chiara lost consciousness.
Now she was adrift in a world that was part dream, part memory. For hours she wandered lost through the streets of her native Venice as the floodwaters of the Acqua Alta swirled around her knees. In a church in Cannaregio, she found Gabriel seated atop a work platform, conversing softly with St. Christopher and St. Jerome. She took him to a canal house near the old Jewish ghetto and made love to him in sheets soaked with blood, while Leah, his wife, watched from her wheelchair in the shadows. A parade of other images filed past, some nightmarish in their depiction, others rendered accurately. She relived the day Gabriel told her he could never marry her, and the day, not 2 years later, when he threw her a surprise wedding on Chemron's terrace overlooking the Sea of Galilee. She walked with Gabriel through the snow-covered killing grounds of Treblinka, and knelt over his broken body in a sodden English pasture, pleading with him not to die. Finally, she saw Gabriel in a garden in Umbria, surrounded by walls of Etruscan stone. He was playing with a child, not the child he had lost in Vienna, but the child Chiara had given to him, the child now growing inside her. She had been a fool to lie to Gabriel. If only she had told him the truth, he would have never gone to London to keep his promise to Grigory Bogdanov, and Chiara would not be the prisoner of a Russian woman, a woman who was now standing over her, syringe in hand. She had milk-white skin and eyes of translucent blue, and appeared to be having difficulty maintaining her balance. This was neither dream nor hallucination. At that moment, Chiara and the woman were caught in a sudden squall in the middle of the Adriatic. Chiara did not know this, of course. She only knew that the woman nearly toppled while giving her an injection of sedative, inserting the needle with far more force than was necessary. Slipping once more into unconsciousness, Chiara returned again to the garden in Umbria. Gabriel was bidding farewell to the child. It wandered into a field of sunflowers and disappeared. Chiara woke once more during the journey, this time by the drone of an aircraft in flight and the stench of her own vomit. The woman was standing over her again, another loaded syringe in hand. Chiara promised to behave, but the woman shook her head and inserted the needle. As the drug took effect, Chiara found herself wandering frantically through the field of sunflowers, searching for the child. The night fell like a curtain, and she was weeping hysterically, with no one to console her. When next she regained consciousness, it was to the sensation of intense cold. For a moment she thought it was another hallucination. Then she realized she was on her feet and somehow walking through snow. Her hands were cuffed and secured to her body by nylon tape, her ankles shackled. The chains of the shackles abbreviated her stride to little more than a shuffle. The two men holding her arms seemed not to mind. They seemed to have all the time in the world. So did the woman with milk-white skin. She was walking a few paces ahead, toward a small cottage surrounded by birch trees. Parked outside were a pair of Mercedes sedans. Judging from their low profile, they had armor plating and bulletproof windows. Leaning against the hood of one was a man, black leather coat, silver hair, head like a tank turret. Chiara had never met him in person, but had seen the face many times in surveillance photographs. His powerful aftershave hung like an invisible fog on the brittle air. Sandalwood and smoke. The smell of power. The smell of the devil. The devil smiled seductively and touched her face. Chiara recoiled, instantly nauseated. At the devil's command, the two men led her into the cottage and down a flight of narrow wooden stairs. At the bottom was a heavy metal door with a thick horizontal latch. Behind it was a small room with a concrete floor and whitewashed walls. They forced her inside and slammed the door. Chiara lay motionless, weeping softly, shivering with the unbearable cold. A moment later, when her eyes had adjusted to the darkness, she realized she was not alone. Propped in one corner, hands and feet bound, was a man. Despite the poor light, Chiara could see he had not shaved in many days. She could also see he had been beaten savagely.
"I am so sorry to see you," he said softly. "You must be Gabriel's wife. Who are you?" "My name is Grigory Bogdanov. Don't say another word. Ivan is listening."
Chapter 39. King Saul Boulevard, Tel Aviv. The office prided itself on its ability to respond quickly in times of crisis, but even battle-hardened veterans of the service would later shake their heads in wonder at the speed with which Gabriel's team sprang into action. They berated the analysts of research to have another look at their files, and hounded the gathering officers of collections to squeeze their sources for the smallest threads of information. They robbed banking of €250,000, and put housekeeping on notice that secure accommodations would be required with little or no advance warning. And finally, they pre-positioned enough electronics and weaponry in Europe to start a small war. But then, that was their intention. Fortunately for Gabriel, he would not go to war alone. He had two powerful allies with great influence and global reach, one in Washington, the other in London. From Adrian Carter, he borrowed a single asset, a female officer who had recently been sent to Europe on temporary duty. Of Graham Seymour, he requested a night raid. The target would be an individual, a man who once boasted he knew more about what was taking place inside Russia than the Russian president himself. Seymour would handle the legwork and logistics. Olga Sukhova would serve as the sharp end of the sword. It was a role long reserved for Shamron. Now he had no task other than to pace the floors with worry, or to make a general nuisance of himself. He looked over shoulders, whispered into ears, and on several occasions pulled Uzi and Gabriel into the hall and jabbed at them with his stubby forefinger. Time and again he heard the same response. "Yes, Harry, we know, we thought of that." And truth be told, they had thought of it, because Shamron had trained them, because they were the best of the best, because they were like his sons, and because they could now do this job without the help of an old man. And so he spent much of that terrible day roaming the upper floors of his beloved King Saul Boulevard, poking his head through doorways, renewing old friendships, making peace with old rivals. There was a pall hanging over the place. It reminded Shamron too much of Vienna. Restless, he requested permission from Amos to go to Ben-Gurion to receive the bodies of Lior and Moti. They were returned to Israel in secret, just as they had served it, with only Shamron and their parents present. He gave them a famous shoulder to cry on, but could tell them nothing about how their sons had died. The experience left him deeply shaken, and he returned to King Saul Boulevard feeling abnormally depressed. His mood improved slightly when he entered room 456C to find Gabriel's team hard at work. Gabriel, however, was not there. He was on his way to Jerusalem, City of Believers. A steady snow was falling as Gabriel pulled into the drive of Mount Herzl Psychiatric Hospital. A sign at the entrance said visiting hours were now over. Gabriel ignored it and went inside. Under an agreement with the hospital's administration, he was allowed to come whenever he wanted. In fact, he rarely came when the family and friends of other patients were around. Israel, a country of just over 5 million people, was in many ways an extended family. Even Gabriel, who conducted his affairs in anonymity, found it difficult to go anywhere without bumping into an acquaintance from Bezalel or the army. Leah's doctor was waiting in the lobby. A rotund figure with a rabbinical beard, he updated Gabriel on Leah's condition as they walked together along a quiet corridor. Gabriel was not surprised to hear it had changed little since his last visit. Leah suffered from a particularly acute combination of psychotic depression and post-traumatic stress syndrome. The bombing in Vienna played ceaselessly in her mind like a loop of videotape. From time to time, she experienced flashes of lucidity, but for the most part, she lived only in the past, trapped in a body that no longer functioned, guilt-ridden over her failure to save her son's life. Does she recognize anyone?
Only Gila Shamron. She comes once a week, sometimes more.
Where is she now?
In the recreation room. We've closed it so you can see her in private.
She was seated in a wheelchair near the window, gazing sightlessly into the garden where snow was collecting on the limbs of the olive trees. Her hair, once long and black, was short and gray. Her hands, twisted and scarred by fire, were folded in her lap. When Gabriel sat next to her, she seemed not to notice. Then her head turned slowly, and a spark of recognition flickered in her eyes.
"Is it really you, Gabriel?"
"Yes, Leah, it's me."
"They said you might be coming. I was afraid you'd forgotten about me."
"No, Leah. I've never forgotten you, not for a minute."
"You've been crying, Gabriel. I can see it in your eyes. Is something wrong?"
"No, Leah, everything's fine."
She gazed into the garden again.
Look at the snow, Gabriel. Isn't it?
She left the thought unfinished. A brief look of horror flashed in her eyes. Gabriel knew she had returned to Vienna. He took hold of her ruined hands and talked about the painting he was restoring, about the villa where he had been living in Italy, about Gila and Marie Chamon. Anything but Vienna. Anything but Chiara. Finally, her gaze fell upon him once more. She was back.
Is it really you, Gabriel?
Yes, Leah. It's me.
I was afraid you'd...
Never, Leah.
You look tired.
I've been working very hard.
And you're too thin. Do you want something to eat?
I'm fine, Leah.
How long can you stay, my love?
Not long.
How is your wife?
She's well, Leah.
Is she pretty?
She's very pretty.
Are you taking good care of her?
His eyes filled with tears. I'm trying my best. She looked away.
Look at the snow, Gabriel. Isn't it beautiful?
Yes, Leah, it's beautiful.
The snow absolves Vienna of its sins. Snow falls on Vienna when the missiles rain on Tel Aviv.
She looked at him again.
Make sure Danny is buckled into his seat tightly. The streets are slippery.
He's fine, Leah.
Give me a kiss.
Gabriel pressed his lips against her scarred cheek. Leah whispered,
One last kiss.
There exists in Tel Aviv and its suburbs a constellation of office safe flats known as jump sites. They are places where, by doctrine and tradition, operatives spend their final night before departing Israel for missions abroad. Neither Gabriel nor any member of his team bothered to go to their assigned site that night. There wasn't time. In fact, they worked straight through the night and were so late arriving at Ben-Gurion that El Al officials had to slip them through the usual gauntlet of security procedures. In another break with tradition, the entire team traveled aboard the same aircraft, El Al Flight 315 to London. Only Gabriel had a role to play that evening. He separated from the others at Heathrow and made his way to Cheyne Walk in Chelsea. A few minutes after six, he rounded the corner into Cheyne Gardens and wrapped his knuckle twice on the back of an unmarked black van. Graham Seymour opened the door and beckoned him inside. The target was in place. The sword was ready. The night raid was about to begin. Chapter 40. Chelsea, London. It was said of Viktor Orlov that he divided people into two categories, those willing to be used and those too stupid to realize they were being used. There were some who would have added a third, those willing to let Viktor steal their money. He made no secret of the fact he was a predator and a robber baron. Indeed, he wore these labels proudly, along with his $10,000 Italian suits and his trademark striped shirts, specially made by a man in Hong Kong. The dramatic collapse of communism had presented Orlov with the opportunity to earn a great deal of money in a brief period of time, and he had taken it. Orlov rarely apologized for anything, least of all the manner in which he had become rich. Had I been born an Englishman, my money might have come to me cleanly, he told a British interviewer shortly after taking up residence in London. But I was born a Russian, and I earned a Russian fortune. Blessed with a natural facility for numbers, Orlov had been working as a physicist in the Soviet nuclear weapons program when the empire finally collapsed. While most of his colleagues continued to work without pay, Orlov decided to go into business and soon earned a small fortune importing computers, appliances, and other Western goods for the nascent Russian market. But his true riches would come later, after he acquired Russia's largest steel company, Angusoil, the Siberian oil giant. Fortune magazine declared Viktor Orlov Russia's richest man and one of the world's most influential businessmen. Not bad for a former government physicist who once had to share a communal apartment with two other Soviet families. In the rough and tumble world of Russia's robber baron capitalism, a fortune like Orlov's could also be a dangerous thing. Quickly made, it could vanish in the blink of an eye, and it could make the holder and his family targets of envy, and sometimes violence.
Orlov had survived at least 3 attempts on his life, and was rumored to have ordered several men killed in retaliation. But the greatest threat to his fortune would come not from those who wished to kill him, but from the Kremlin. The current Russian president believed men like Orlov had stolen the country's most valuable assets, and it was his intention to steal them back. Shortly after taking control, he summoned Orlov to the Kremlin and demanded 2 things, his steel company and Ruse Oil.
"And keep your nose out of politics," he added. "Otherwise, I'm going to cut it off."
Orlov agreed to relinquish his steel interests, but not his oil company. The president was not amused. He immediately ordered his prosecutors to open a fraud and bribery investigation, and within a week a warrant was issued for Orlov's arrest. Orlov wisely fled to London. The target of a Russian extradition request, he still maintained nominal control of his shares in Ruse Oil, now valued at $12 billion. But they remained legally icebound, beyond the reach of both Orlov and the man who wanted them back, the Russian president. Early in Orlov's exile, the press had hung on his every word. A reliable source of incendiary copy about Kremlin skullduggery, he could fill a room with reporters with an hour's notice. But the British press had tired of Viktor, just as the British people had grown weary of Russians in general. Few cared what he had to say anymore, and fewer still had the time or patience to sit through one of his lengthy tirades against his arch-rival, the Russian president. And so it came as no surprise to Gabriel and his team when Orlov readily accepted a request for an interview from one Olga Sukova, former crusading reporter from Moskovskaya Gazeta, now in exile herself. Due to concerns over her security, she asked to see Orlov in his home and at night. Orlov, a bachelor and relentless womanizer, suggested she come at 7. "And please, come alone," he added before ringing off. She did indeed come at 7, though she was hardly alone. A maid took her coat and escorted her to the second floor study, where Orlov greeted her lavishly in Russian. Gabriel and Graham Seymour, headphones over their ears, listened to the simultaneous translation.
"It's so lovely to see you again after all these years, Olga. Can I get you some tea or something stronger?"
Chapter 41. Chelsea, London.
"Tea would be fine, thank you."
Orlov could not conceal his disappointment. No doubt he had been hoping to impress Olga with a bottle or two of the Chateau Petrus he drank like tap water. He ordered tea and savories from the maid, then watched with obvious satisfaction as Olga pretended to admire the vast office. It was rumored Orlov had been so impressed by his first visit to Buckingham Palace, he had instructed his army of interior decorators to recreate its atmosphere at Cheyne Walk. The room, which was 3 times the size of Olga's old Moscow apartment, had reportedly been inspired by the Queen's private study. As Olga endured a tedious tour, she could not help but reflect upon how different her life was from Victor's. Freed from communism's yoke, Viktor had gone in search of money, while Olga had set out to find truth. She had spent the better part of her career investigating the misdeeds of men like Viktor Orlov, and believed such men bore much of the blame for the death of freedom and democracy in her country. Orlov's greed had helped to create the unique set of circumstances that had allowed the Kremlin to return the country to the authoritarianism of the past. Indeed, were it not for men like Viktor Orlov, the Russian president might still be a low-level functionary in the St. Petersburg city government. Instead, he ruled the world's largest country with an iron fist and was thought to be one of Europe's richest men, richer even than Orlov himself. The tea arrived. They sat on opposite ends of the long brocade couch, facing a window hung with rich floor-to-ceiling drapery. It might have been possible to see Chelsea Embankment and the Thames had the curtains not been tightly drawn as a precaution against snipers. Ironic, since Orlov had spent several million pounds acquiring one of London's best views. He was wearing a dark blue suit and a shirt with stripes the color of cranberries. One arm was flung back of the couch toward Olga, revealing a diamond and gold wristwatch of inestimable worth. The other lay along the armrest. He was twirling his spectacles restlessly. Veteran Orlov watchers would have recognized the tick. Orlov was perpetually in motion, even when he was sitting still.
"Please, Olga, remind me when it was we last met."
Orlov watchers would have recognized this, too.
Victor was not the sort to blurt, "I never forget a face." He actually made a habit of pretending to forget people. It was a negotiating tactic. It said to opponents they were unmemorable, insignificant, without merit or consequence. Olga cared little about what Orlov thought of her, so she answered the question honestly. They had met just once, she reminded him. The encounter had taken place in Moscow, shortly before he fled to London.
Ah, yes, I remember it now. If I recall, I became very angry at you, because you were not interested in some valuable information I had for you.
If I had written the story you wanted me to write, I would have been killed.
The fearless Olga Sukhova was afraid?
That had never stopped you before.
From what I hear, you're lucky to be alive. The Kremlin never said what happened in that stairwell last summer, but I know the truth. You were investigating Ivan Kharkov, and Ivan tried to silence you. Permanently.
Olga made no reply.
So you don't deny that's what happened?
Your sources have always been impeccable, Victor.
He acknowledged the compliment with a twirl of his eyewear.
It's a shame. We haven't had the opportunity to meet again until now. As you might expect, I followed your case with great interest. I tried to find some way of making contact with you after your defection was made public, but you were quite difficult to locate. I asked my friends in British intelligence to pass a message to you, but they refused.
Why didn't you just ask Grigori when I lost?
The spectacles went still, just for a few seconds.
I did, but he refused to tell me. I know you two are friends. I suppose he doesn't want to share you.
Olga took note of the tense. I know you two are friends. He didn't seem to know about Grigori's absence, unless he was lying, which was a distinct possibility. Victor Orlov was genetically incapable of telling the truth.
The old Victor wouldn't have bothered to ask Grigori where I was hiding. He would have just had him followed.
Don't think it didn't cross my mind.
But you never did.
Follow Grigori. He shook his head. The British give my bodyguards a good deal of latitude, but they would never tolerate private surveillance operations. Remember, I am still a Russian citizen. I am also the target of a formal extradition request. I try not to do anything to make my British hosts too angry.
Other than criticize the Kremlin whenever you feel like it.
They can't expect me to remain mute. When I see injustice, I am compelled to speak. It's my nature. That's why Grigori and I get along so well.
He paused and then asked,
How is he, by the way?
Grigori? She sipped her tea and said she hadn't spoken to him for several weeks.
You?
Actually, I had one of my assistants put a call to him the other day.
You never heard back.
I assume he's very busy on his book.
Olav gave her a conspiratorial glance.
Some of my people have been working with Grigori in secret. As you might expect, I want this book to be a big success.
Why am I not surprised, Victor?
It's my nature. I enjoy helping others. It is why I am so pleased you are here. Tell me about the story you're working on. Tell me how I can be of service.
It's a story about a defector. A defector who disappeared without a trace.
Does the defector have a name?
Grigori Nikolaevich Bulganov.
In the surveillance van, Graham Seymour removed his headphones and looked at Gabriel.
Very nicely played.
She's good, Graham. Very good.
Can I have her when you're done?
Gabriel raised a finger to his lips. Victor Orlov was speaking again. They heard a burst of rapid Russian, followed by the voice of the translator.
Tell me what you know, Olga. Tell me everything.
Chapter 42. Chelsea, London. Orlov was suddenly in motion in several places at once. The spectacles were twirling, the fingers were drumming on the back of the brocade couch, and the left eye was twitching anxiously. When he was a child, the twitch had made him the target of merciless teasing and bullying. It had made him burn with hatred, and that hatred had driven him to succeed. Victor Orlov wanted to beat everyone, and it was all because of the twitch in his left eye.
Are you sure he's missing?
I'm sure.
When did he disappear?
January the 10th. 6:12 in the evening on his way to chess.
How do you know this?
I'm Olga Sukova. I know everything.
Do the British know?
Of course.
What do they think happened?
They believe he redefected. They think he's now back in Lublyanka, telling his superiors everything he learned about your operation while he was working for you.
The eye was now blinking involuntarily like the shutter of a high-speed automatic camera.
Why didn't they tell me?
I'm not sure you were their first concern, Victor. But don't worry, it's not true about Grigori. He didn't redefect. He was kidnapped.
She let it sink in, then added,
"By Ivan Karkov."
How do you know this?
I'm Olga Sukova.
And you know everything?
Not quite everything. But perhaps you can help me fill in some of the missing pieces. I don't know the identity of this man Ivan hired to handle the kidnapping. All I know is that this man is very good. He's a professional.
She paused.
The kind of man you used to hire in Moscow, in the bad old days, Victor, when you had a problem that just wouldn't go away.
Be careful, Miss Sukova.
I'm always careful. I never had to print a single retraction in all the years I worked for the Gazeta. Not one.
That's because you never wrote a story about me.
If I had, it would have been airtight and completely accurate.
So you say?
I know a great deal about the way you made your money, Victor. I did you a favor by never publishing that information in the Gazeta. And now you're going to do one for me. You're going to help me find the man who kidnapped my friend. And if you don't, I'm going to pour everything I have in my notebooks into the most unflattering expose ever written about you.
And I'll take you to court.
Court? Do you really think I'm afraid of a British court?
She reached into her handbag and withdrew a photograph, a man standing in the arrivals hall of Heathrow Airport. Orlov slipped on his spectacles. The eye twitched nervously. He pressed a button on the side table, and the maid materialized.
Bring me a bottle of Petrus, now!
He tried to slip out of the noose, of course, but Olga was having none of it. She calmly recited a couple of names, a date, and the details of a certain transaction involving a company Victor once owned, just enough to let him know her threats were not idle. Victor drank his first glass of Petrus quickly and poured another. Olga had never seen Victor show fear before, but he was clearly afraid now. An experienced reporter, she recognized the manifestations of that fear in the behavior that came next. The exclamations of disbelief, the attempts at misdirection, the effort to foist blame onto others. Victor tended to blame all his problems on Russia, so it came as no surprise to Olga when he did so now.
You have to remember what it was like in the 90s. We tried to snap our fingers and turn Russia into a normal capitalist country overnight. It wasn't possible. It was utopian thinking, just like communism.
I remember, Victor, I was there too.
Then you surely recall what it was like for people like me, who were able to make a bit of money. Everyone wanted a piece of it. Our lives were in constant danger, along with the lives of our families. There was the mafia, of course, but sometimes our competitors were just as dangerous. Everyone hired private armies to protect themselves and to wage war on their rivals. It was the Wild East.
Olav held the goblet of wine up to the light. Heavy and rich, it glowed like freshly spilled blood.
There was no shortage of soldiers. No one wanted to work for the government anymore.
Not when there was real money to be made in the private sector. Officers were leaving the Russian security services in droves. Some didn't bother to quit their jobs. They just put in an hour or two at the office and moonlighted. Olga had once written an expose about this practice, a story about a pair of FSB officers who investigated the Russian mafia by day and killed for them by night. The FSB men had vehemently denied the story. Then they had threatened to kill her.
Some of these men weren't very talented.
Olav continued,
they could handle simple jobs, street killings and the like. But there were others who were highly trained professionals.
Olav studied the photograph.
This man fell into the second category.
You've met him.
He hesitated, then nodded.
It was in Moscow, in another lifetime. I'm not going to discuss the nature or circumstances of this meeting.
I don't care about the meeting, Victor. I only want to know about the man in that photograph.
He drank some more of the wine and relented.
His KGB codename was Comrade Zhirlov. He specialized in assassinations, abductions, and finding men who wished not to be found. He was also supposed to be very good with poisons and toxins. He put those skills to good use when he went into private practice. He did the kind of jobs others might refuse because they were too dangerous. It made him rich. He worked inside Russia for a few years, then broadened his horizons.
Where did he go?
Western Europe. He speaks several languages and has many passports from his days with the KGB.
Where does he live?
Who knows? And I doubt even the famous Olga Sukova will be able to find him. In fact, I highly recommend you forget about trying. You'll only get yourself killed.
Obviously, he's still selling his services on the open market.
That is what I've heard. I've also heard his prices have increased dramatically. Only men like Ivan Karkov can afford to hire him any longer.
And you, Viktor?
I've never engaged in such things.
And no one is making that accusation. But let us suppose one required the services of a man like this. How would one make contact with him? Where would one go?
Viktor lapsed into silence. He was a Russian, and like all Russians, he suspected someone was always listening. In this case, he happened to be correct. For a moment, the two men seated in the back of the MI5 surveillance van feared their source was unwilling to take the final step. Then they heard a single word that required no translation.
Geneva.
There was a man there, Olav said, a security consultant to wealthy Russians, a broker, a middleman.
I believe his name is Chernov.
Yes, I'm sure of it now, Chernov. Does he have a first name?
It might be Vladimir.
Do you happen to know where he keeps his office?
Just off the Rue du Mont Blanc.
I believe I might have the address. You wouldn't have a telephone number, would you?
Actually, I might have his mobile.
Under normal circumstances, Gabriel would never have bothered to write down the name and telephone number. Now, with his wife in Yvonne's hands, he did not trust his usually flawless memory. By the time he had finished jotting down the information, Olga was slipping through Victor's wrought iron gate. A taxi collected her and brought her around the corner to Cheney Gardens. Gabriel climbed in next to her and headed to London City Airport, where an American-supplied Gulfstream G500 was waiting. The rest of his team was already on board, along with its newest addition, Sarah Bancroft. The tower log would later show the plane departed at 10:18 p.m. For reasons never explained, its destination was not recorded. Chapter 43 King Saul Boulevard, Tel Aviv. It might not have seemed like much, a name, a business address, a pair of phone numbers, but in the hands of an intelligence service like the office, it was enough to open a man up stem to stern. Chemron gave the information to the bloodhounds of research and shot it across the Atlantic to Langley as well. Then, with Rami at his side, he headed home to Tiberias. It was after midnight when he arrived. He undressed in the darkness and crept into bed quietly so as not to wake Gila. He didn't bother to close his eyes. Sleep came rarely, and never under circumstances like these. Rather than try, he relived each minute of the past 2 days and explored the remotest regions of his past. And he wondered when he might be given the chance to do something of value, something other than making a nuisance of himself or taking in a message from London. And he wrestled with two questions. Where was Yvonne, and why hadn't they heard from him? Oddly enough, Chemron was focused on that very thought when the telephone at his bedside rang at 4:13 a.m. He knew the exact time because, out of habit, he glanced at his wristwatch before answering. Fearful he was about to be informed of yet another death, he held the receiver to his ear for a moment before grumbling his name. The voice that responded was instantly familiar. It was the voice of an old rival, the voice of an occasional ally. He wanted a word with Chemron in private. He was wondering whether Chemron was free to come to Paris. In fact, said the voice, it would be wise for Chemron to find some way of getting on the 9 o'clock flight out of Ben-Gurion. Yes, said the voice, it was urgent. No, it couldn't wait. Chamron hung up the phone and switched on the bedside lamp. Gila rose and went to make the coffee. Ivan had chosen his envoy with care. There were few people who had been in the trade longer than Ari Chamron, but Sergei Korovin was one of them. After spending the 1950s in Eastern Europe, the KGB taught him to speak Arabic and sent him off to make mischief in the Middle East. He went first to Baghdad, then Damascus, then Tripoli, and finally Cairo. It was in the tense summer of 1973 that Korovin and Chamron first crossed paths. Operation Wrath of God was in full swing in Europe. The terrorists of Black September were killing Israelis wherever they could be found, and Chamron alone was convinced the Egyptians were preparing for war. He had a spy in Cairo who was telling him so, a spy who was then arrested by the Egyptian Secret Service. With his execution just hours away, Chamron had reached out to Korovin and asked him to intercede. After weeks of negotiations, Chamron's spy was allowed to stagger across the Israeli lines in the Sinai. He had been severely beaten and tortured, but he was alive. 1 month later, as Israel was preparing for Yom Kippur, the Egyptians staged a surprise attack. By the mid-1970s, Sergei Korovin was back in Moscow, working his way steadily up the ranks of the KGB. Promoted to general, he was placed in charge of Department 18, which dealt with the Arab world, and was later given command of Directorate R, which handled operational planning and analysis. In 1984, he took control of the entire First Chief Directorate, a position he held until the KGB was disbanded by Boris Yeltsin. If given the chance, Sergei Korovin would have probably killed the Russian president himself. Instead, he burned his most sensitive files and went quietly into retirement. But Chamron knew better than anyone there was really no such thing, especially for Russians. There was a saying within the Brotherhood of the Sword and the Shield, once a KGB officer, always a KGB officer. Only in death was one truly free. And sometimes, not even then. Chamron and Korovin had maintained contact over the years. They had met to swap stories, share information, and do each other the occasional favor. It would have been wrong to describe them as friends, more like kindred spirits. They knew the rules of the game and shared a healthy cynicism for the men they served. Korovin was also one of the few people in the world who could keep pace with Chamron's tobacco intake. And like Chamron, he had little patience for trivial matters, such as food, fashion, or even money.
"It's a shame Sergei wasn't born an Israeli," Chamron once told Gabriel. "I would have enjoyed having him on our side."
Chamron knew time could be hard on Russian men. They tended to age in the blink of an eye, young and virile 1 minute, wrinkled paper the next. But the man who entered the salon of the Hotel des Clients shortly after 3 that afternoon was still the tall, erect figure Chamron had first met many years earlier. 2 bodyguards trailed slowly behind him. 2 others had arrived an hour earlier and were seated not far from Chamron. They were drinking tea. Chamron, mineral water. Rami had delivered the bottle himself, after instructing the bartender not to remove the cap, and twice requesting clean glasses. Even so, Chamron had yet to touch it. He was wearing his dark suit and silver tie. Chamron, the shady businessman who played baccarat well. Like Chamron, Sergei Korovin could discuss matters of import in many different languages. Most of their meetings had been conducted in German, and it was German they spoke now. Korovin, after settling himself into a chair, immediately thumbed open a silver cigarette case. Chamron had to remind him smoking was no longer permitted in Paris. Korovin frowned.
"Do they still let you drink vodka? If you ask nicely." "I'm like you, Ari. I don't ask for anything."
He ordered a vodka, then looked at Chamron.
"It was reassuring to hear your voice last night. I was afraid you might be dead. It's the hardest thing about growing old, the death of one's friends." "I never knew you had any."
"Friends? A couple." He gave a faint smile.
"You always played the game well, Ari. You had many admirers at Yazenevo. We studied your operations. We even learned a thing or two."
Yazenevo was the old headquarters of the First Chief Directorate, sometimes referred to as Moscow Center. It was now headquarters of the SVR.
"Where's my file?"
Shamrone asked.
Locked away where it belongs.
For a time I feared all our dirty laundry would be made public.
Thankfully the new regime put an end to that. Our president understands that he who controls history controls the future. He lauds the achievements of the Soviet Union while minimizing its so-called crimes and abuses.
And you approve?
Of course, Russia has no democratic tradition. To have democracy in Russia would be tantamount to imposing Islamic law in Israel.
Do you see my point, Ari?
I believe I do, Sergei.
The waiter presented the vodka with great ceremony and withdrew. Korovin drank without hesitation.
So, Ari, now that we are alone...
Are we alone, Sergei?
No one but my security.
He paused.
And you, Ari?
Shamrone glanced at Rami, who was seated near the entrance of the ornate salon, pretending to read the Herald Tribune.
Just one. Trust me, Sergei. One is all I need.
That's not what I hear. I'm told a couple of your boys got themselves killed the other night, and the Italians are trying to keep it quiet for you. It won't work, by the way. My sources tell me the story is going to blow up in your face tomorrow morning in one of the big Italian dailies.
Really? And what's the story going to say?
That two office agents were killed during a drive through the Italian countryside.
But nothing about an agent being kidnapped?
No.
And the perpetrators?
There will be speculation. It's an Iranian job.
He paused, then said,
But we both know that's not true.
Korovin drank more of his vodka. The topic had been broached. Now both men would have to proceed carefully. Shamrone knew that Korovin was in a position to admit little. It didn't matter. The Russian could say more with a raised eyebrow than most men manage during an hour-long lecture. Shamrone made the next move.
We've always been honest with each other, Sergei.
As honest as two men can be in this business.
So let me be honest with you now.
We believe our agent was taken by Ivan Korkov.
We believe it was in retaliation for an operation we ran against him last fall.
I know all about your operation, Ari. The whole world does. But Ivan Korkov had absolutely nothing to do with the disappearance of this woman.
Shamrone ignored everything about Korovin's response except for a single word. Woman. It was all he needed to know. The Russian had just laid his bona fides upon the table. The negotiation could now begin. It would follow a set of carefully prescribed guidelines and be conducted mainly with falsehoods and half-truths. Nothing would be admitted, and no demands would ever be stated. It wasn't necessary. Shamrone and Korovin both spoke the language of lies.
Are you sure, Sergei? Are you sure Ivan's hands are clean?
I've spoken to representatives of Ivan personally.
Another pause, then.
Have you heard anything about the condition of the woman?
Only that she's alive and being well cared for.
That's good to know, Sergei. If that could continue, we would be most grateful.
I'll see what I can do. As you know, Ivan is very upset about his current circumstances.
He has no one to blame but himself.
Ivan doesn't see it that way. He believes these charges and accusations in the West are all lies and fabrications. He would have never been so foolish as to enter into a deal to supply our missiles to Al-Qaeda. In fact, he assures me he's not even involved in the arms business.
I'll make sure to pass that along to the Americans.
There's something else you should pass along.
Anything, Sergei.
Ivan believes his children were taken from him illegally in France last summer. Ivan wants them back.
Shamrone shrugged his shoulders, feigning surprise.
I never knew the Americans had them.
We believe this to be the case, despite the official statements to the contrary. Perhaps someone could put in a good word with the Americans on Ivan's behalf.
No, it was Korobin's turn to shrug.
I couldn't say for certain, but I believe it would go a long way toward helping you recover your missing agent.
Korovin had just taken another step closer toward offering a quid pro quo. Shamrone chose the path of prevarication.
We are not a large service like you, Sergei. We are a small family. We want our agent back and are willing to do whatever we can. But I have very little sway over the Americans. If they do have the children, it's unlikely they would agree to hand them over to Yvonne, even under circumstances such as these.
You give yourself too little credit, Ari.
Go to the Americans. Talk some sense into them. Convince them to put Yvonne's children on a plane. Once they are in Russia, where they belong, I'm certain your agent will turn up.
Kurovin had laid a contract on the table. Shamron did due diligence.
Safe and sound?
Safe and sound.
There is one other matter, Sergei. We want Grigory Bolganov back as well.
Grigory Bolganov is none of your concern.
Shamron conceded the point.
And if I'm able to convince the Americans to surrender the children, how long would we have to make the arrangements?
I couldn't say for certain, but not terribly long.
I need to know, Sergei.
My response would only be hypothetical in nature.
All right, hypothetically speaking, how long do we have?
Kurovin sipped his vodka and said, 72 hours.
That's not long, Sergei.
It is what it is.
How do I contact you?
You don't. We'll meet again on Tuesday at 4 p.m. As one friend to another, I would strongly advise you to have an answer by then.
Where shall we meet?
Is one still permitted to smoke in the Jardin des Tuileries?
For now.
Then let's meet there. The benches near the Jeu de Pont.
4 o'clock.
Kurovin nodded.
4 o'clock.
Chapter 44. Hotel Bristol, Geneva. The news from Paris was quickly flashed to several points around the globe, to the operations desk at Kingsall Boulevard, to Thames House in London, and to CIA headquarters in Langley, and to the stately Hotel Bristol in Geneva, temporary home of Gabriel and his team. Though they were deeply relieved to hear Chiara was indeed alive, there was nothing resembling celebration. Yvonne's terms were, of course, unacceptable. They were unacceptable to Shamron, unacceptable to the Americans, and especially unacceptable to Gabriel. No one was prepared to ask Elena Korkov to sacrifice her children, least of all a man who had once lost one of his own. Yvonne's offer did serve one valuable purpose, though. It gave them a bit of time and some additional room to maneuver. Not much time, just 72 hours, and very little room. They were going to pursue Chiara and Grigory along parallel paths. One was the path of negotiation, the other the path of violence. Gabriel would have to move quickly, and he would be forced to take chances. For now he had just one man in his sights, Vladimir Chernov.
Everything Viktor Orlov said checks out, Nabot told Gabriel late that afternoon over coffee in the piano bar. We are monitoring his phones and keeping watch on his office and apartment. Kingsall Boulevard is making headway on getting into his computers. He's got good security software, but it won't keep the cyber boys out long.
How much do we know about his past?
He was definitely KGB. He worked in the 9th Directorate, the division that protected Soviet leaders and the Kremlin. Apparently, Chernov was assigned to Gorbachev's detail at the end.
And when the KGB disbanded?
He wasted very little time going into private practice. He formed a security company in Moscow and advised the newly rich on how to keep themselves and their valuables safe. He did quite well for himself.
When did he set up shop here?
5 years ago. Langley's had concerns about him for some time. The Americans won't shed a tear if he has a mishap.
Age? 46. Physically fit, I take it.
He's built like Lenin's tomb, and he keeps in shape.
Nabot handed Gabriel his PDA. On the screen was a surveillance photograph shot earlier that afternoon. It showed Chernov entering his office building. He was a big man, over 6 feet tall, with deeply receded hair and small eyes set in a round, fleshy face. Does he have a security detail of his own?
Rides around town in a big Audi sedan. The windows are clearly bulletproof. So is the guy who sits at his side. I'd say that both the bodyguard and the driver are extremely well armed.
Family?
The ex-wife and children are back in Moscow. He's got a girlfriend here in Geneva. Swiss? Russian. A kid from the provinces. Sells gloves around the corner from Chernov's office.
Does the kid have a name?
Ludmila Akulova. They're having dinner out tonight, a restaurant called Les Amours.
Gabriel knew it. It was in the old town near the Hotel de Ville.
What time?
8:30. How far is Vladimir's apartment from Les Amours?
Not far. He lives near the cathedral.
What's the building like?
Small and traditional. There's an intercom with a keypad at the street entrance. Tenants can use their keys or punch in the code. We had a look inside earlier this afternoon. There's an elevator, but Vladimir's flat is just one floor up.
And the street?
Even in the middle of the day, it's quiet. At night,
Nabot's voice trailed off.
Dead.
Ever eaten at Leonor's?
Can't say I've had the pleasure.
If they sit down to dinner at 8:30, it's going to be late by the time they get to that apartment.
You'll take him then. You're assuming Ludmila will be accompanying him?
Yes, Uzi, I'm assuming that.
What are we going to do with her?
Scare the daylights out of her and leave her behind.
What about the driver and the bodyguard?
I'm going to need them to make a point.
They're going to require a diversion of some sort.
Your diversion is upstairs in room 702.
She's registered under the name Irene Moore. Her real name is Sarah Bancroft.
Where do you want to take them?
Somewhere on the other side of the border.
Somewhere isolated.
Tell housekeeping we're going to need maid service.
Tell them it's going to be messy.
There are many sophisticates who dismiss Geneva as dull and provincial. A Calvinist handmaiden too frigid to loosen her blouse. But they have not heard the peal of her church bells on a cold winter's night, or watched snowflakes settling gently over her cobblestone streets. And they have not dined at a quiet corner table at Les Amours in the company of a beautiful Russian woman. The salads were crisp, the veal superb, and the wine, a 2006 Bâtard Montrachet by Joseph Tourand, was delivered at the perfect temperature by an attentive sommelier. They took their time with the cognac, customary on a snowy February night in Geneva, and at 11 o'clock were holding hands as they climbed into the back of the Mercedes sedan parked outside the old arsenal. All signs pointed to a night of passion at the apartment near the cathedral. That indeed might have been the case, were it not for the woman waiting outside the entrance in the snow. She had skin like alabaster, and was wearing a leather jacket and fishnet stockings. Had her makeup not been smeared from a night of weeping, she might have been very pretty. The couple who emerged from the back of the Mercedes initially paid her little attention. A waif, they must have thought. A working girl. Maybe a drug addict. Certainly no threat to a man like Vladimir Chernov. After all, Chernov had once served as bodyguard to the last leader of the Soviet Union. Chernov could handle anything. Or so he thought. Her voice was plaintive at first, childlike. She referred to Chernov by his first name, clearly a shock, and accused him of many crimes of the heart. He had made declarations of love, she said. He had made promises about the future. He had pledged financial support for the child she was now caring for alone. With Ludmila now seething, Chernov tried to tell the woman she had obviously mistaken him for someone else. This earned him a hard slap across the face, which had the effect of drawing the bodyguards from the car. The melee that ensued lasted precisely 27 seconds. A video recording of it exists and is used for training purposes to this day. It must be said that, at the outset, Chernov's Russian bodyguards acted with admirable restraint. Confronted with a young woman who was clearly disturbed and delusional, they tried to bring her gently under control and remove her from the immediate area. Her reaction, two hard kicks to their shins, served only to escalate matters. The situation intensified with the arrival of four gentlemen who just happened to be walking along the quiet street. The largest of the four, a heavy-shouldered man with strawberry blonde hair, went in first, followed by a dark-haired man with a pockmarked face. Words were exchanged, threats were made, and finally punches were thrown. These were not the wild, undisciplined blows thrown by amateurs. They were tight and brutal, the kind that were capable of inflicting permanent damage. Under the right circumstances, they could even cause instant death. But instant death was not their goal, and the four gentlemen tempered their assault to make certain it only rendered their victims unconscious. Once the men were incapacitated, two parked cars came suddenly to life.
Vladimir Chernov was thrown into one, his bodyguards into the other. As for Ludmila Akulova, she escaped with only a verbal warning, delivered in fluent Russian by a man with a bloodless face and eyes the color of glacial ice. "If you say a word about this, we will kill you. And then we'll kill your parents. And then we'll kill every member of your family." As the cars sped away, Gabriel found himself unable to look away from Ludmilla's stricken face. He believed in the women. The women, he said, were Russia's only hope. Chapter 45. Haute-Savoie, France. The house stood in the Haute-Savoie region of France, in an isolated valley above the shores of Lake Annecy. Neat and tidy, with a steeply pitched roof, it was more than a kilometer from its nearest neighbor. Yossi had moved in the previous evening, posing as a British writer of mysteries, and had carefully prepared the premises for the interrogation that was to come. He was standing outside as the two cars made their way slowly up the winding road, snow falling through the beams of their headlamps. Gabriel emerged alone from the front passenger seat of the first car, a Renault station wagon, and followed Yossi into the sitting room of the house. The furniture was piled in one corner, the tile floor covered entirely in plastic drop cloths. In an open hearth burned a large fire, just as Gabriel had ordered. He added two more logs, then headed outside again. A third car had pulled into the drive. Ailey Levon was leaning against the hood. "Were we followed?" Gabriel asked. Levon shook his head. "You're sure, Ailey?"
"I'm sure."
"Take Yossi. Go back to Geneva. Wait there with the others. We won't be long."
"I'm staying here with you."
"You're a watcher, Ailey. The best there ever was. This isn't for you."
"Maybe it isn't for you either."
Gabriel ignored the remark and glanced at Mavot, who was behind the wheel of the Renault. A moment later, three Russians, sedated and trussed, were wobbling drunkenly toward the entrance of the house. Levon placed a hand on Gabriel's shoulder.
"Be careful in there, Gabriel. If you're not, you might lose more than another wife."
Levon climbed behind the wheel of the car without another word and headed down the valley. Gabriel watched the red taillights disappear behind a veil of snow, then turned and headed into the house. They stripped them to their underwear and secured them to a trio of metal outdoor chairs. Gabriel gave each of the three men a shot of stimulant, small doses for the bodyguard and driver, a larger one for Vladimir Chernov. His head rose slowly from his chest, and blinking rapidly, he surveyed his surroundings. His two men were seated directly in front of him, eyes wide with terror. Standing in a line behind them were Yakov, Mikhail, Mavot, and Gabriel. In Gabriel's left hand was a .45 caliber Glock with the suppressor screwed onto the end of the barrel. In his right was a photograph, a man standing in the arrivals hall of Heathrow Airport. Gabriel glanced at Yakov, who tore away the packing tape wrapped around the lower portion of Chernov's head. Now missing a good deal of hair, Chernov screamed in pain. Gabriel hit him hard across the brow with the Glock and told him to shut his mouth. Chernov, blood streaming into his left eye, obeyed.
"Do you know who I am, Vladimir?"
"I've never seen you before in my life. Please, whoever you are, this is all some sort..."
"It's no mistake, Vladimir. Take a good look at my face. You've seen it before, I'm sure."
"No, never."
"We're getting off to a bad start, you and I. You're lying to me, and if you continue to lie to me, you will never leave this place. Tell me the truth, Vladimir, and you and your men will be allowed to live."
"I am telling you the truth. I have never seen your face before."
"Not even in photographs. Surely they must have given you a photo of me."
"Who?"
"The men who came to you when they wanted to hire Comrade Zhirlov to find me."
"I've never heard of this man. I am a legitimate security consultant. I demand you release me and my men at once. Otherwise..."
"Otherwise what, Vladimir?"
Chernov fell silent.
"You have a narrow window of opportunity, Vladimir. A very narrow window. I am going to ask you a question, and you are going to tell me the truth."
Gabriel held the photograph in front of Chernov's face.
"Tell me where I can find this man."
"I've never seen him before in my life."
"Are you sure that's the answer you want to give me, Vladimir?"
"It's the truth!"
Gabriel shook his head sadly and walked behind Chernov's driver. Gabriel had been told his name. He had already forgotten it. His name didn't matter. He didn't need a name where he was going. Chernov, judging by his insolent expression, clearly thought Gabriel was bluffing. Obviously, the Russian had never heard of Ari Shamron's 12th commandment. We do not wave our guns around like gangsters and make idle threats. We draw our weapons in the field for one reason, and one reason only. Gabriel placed the gun to the back of the man's head and tilted the angle slightly downward. Then, with his eyes boring into Chernov's face, he squeezed the trigger. Chapter 46. At Savoie, France. There is a popular misconception about suppressors. They do not actually silence the weapon, especially when that weapon is a 45 caliber Glock. The hollow tipped round into the driver's skull with a rather loud thump and exited through his mouth, taking much of his jaw and chin with it. Had the gun been level at the time of firing, the projectile might have continued into Vladimir Chernov. Instead, it slammed harmlessly into the floor. Chernov didn't escape completely unscathed, though. His muscular torso was now splattered with blood, brain tissue, and bone fragments. A few seconds later came the contents of his own stomach, the fine meal he had shared with Ludmila Akulova a few hours earlier at Leomor's. It was a good sign. Chernov may have trafficked in death and violence, but the sight of a little blood made him sick. With luck, he might break soon. Gabriel held the photograph in front of his face again and posed the same question. Who is this man? And where can I find him? Unfortunately, Chernov's response was the same. I'm sure you've heard of waterboarding, Vladimir. We have a different technique we use when we need information quickly. Gabriel gazed into the fire for a moment. We call it fireboarding. He looked at Chernov again. Have you ever seen a man fireboarded before, Vladimir? When Chernov made no response, Gabriel shot a glance at the others. Novotnikov seized hold of the second bodyguard, and still attached to the chair, rammed him face first into the fire. They let him in no more than 10 seconds. Even so, when he emerged, his hair was smoking and his face blackened and blistered. He was also screaming in agony. They set him directly in front of Chernov, so that the Russian could see the horrible result of his intransigence. Then Gabriel placed the Glock against the back of the bodyguard's head and ended his suffering. Chernov, now drenched in blood, gazed in horror at the two dead men before him. Mikhail covered his mouth with duct tape and gave him a hard backhand across the cheek. Gabriel placed the photograph in his lap and said he would be back in 5 minutes. He returned at the 59th second of the 4th minute and ripped the duct tape from Chernov's mouth. Then he gave him a stark choice. They could have a pleasant conversation, one professional to another, or Chernov could go into the fire like his now-deceased bodyguard. It wouldn't be a quick sear, Gabriel warned. It would be a slow roast, one limb at a time, and there would be no bullet to the back of the head to quell the pain. Gabriel did not have to wait long for his answer. 10 seconds, no more. Chernov said he wanted to talk. Chernov said he was sorry. Chernov said he wanted to help.